Maybe Congress will listen to us.
If I was a Wall Street banker,
or a car company CEO,
or the head of a giant drug company.
Hey Congress, we may be just kids, but right now we need help too.
Our school days are being cut.
So is art, music, and PE.
Our teachers are being laid off.
So our classrooms are more crowded than ever.
So Congress, who do I have to be?
To get your attention.
Call Congress and tell them to pass the Education Jobs Fund, because it's time to speak up for education and kids.
Hi everybody, this is Brett, and welcome back to the School Sucks Podcast for June 7th, 2011. Today we are going to continue our little look at these teachers' unions. And I said in Teachers Unions 101 that there is a system in this country that makes a lot of the rhetorical trickery that these unions do to push their agenda go unnoticed. That system, of course, is school. It leaves people without any intellectual self-defense. And even if they, you know, find themselves disagreeing with what the public employee unions are pushing for or what they want or what they want to prevent, they often really don't know how to counter the arguments that are being put forward. I mean, if you're a so-called Republican, you're just against the public unions because you're just against the unions, because your dad was a Republican and stuff. But there's reasons why people should be against what these public employee unions are trying to do, and I want to pick apart some of the logic, for lack of a better word, and some of the misinformation that they are currently putting forward in Wisconsin. That situation now has been going on for 4 months, and there are some interesting new developments there. Now, I have to tell you that I have recorded and scrapped numerous potential shows on this subject. I thought that this was going to be like an 8-part series, but, you know, I would record for 15, 20 minutes, and I would listen back to it, and I'd be like, wow, that's just the sound of me bitching, and it's not really productive. So today, I think I have a way to look at some of the developments in this situation where it could be productive and it could be helpful, and maybe we could learn something, because that should be the point of what we're doing here. So, a story broke, I think on the 5th of June, and this is from CNN.com. And the title of this story is Wisconsin Activists Create Walkerville to Taunt Governor and Tout Change. 80 years after Hoovervilles sprang up around the country, and 4 months after tens of thousands descended on the Wisconsin state capitol, progressives have a new home in what they're calling Walkerville. The Madison Tent City is named in honor, or more accurately, in defiance of Governor Scott Walker, who became an icon for conservatives and a lightning rod for liberals after he pushed through a controversial new collective bargaining law earlier this year. David Boucher, one of Walkerville's coordinators, said the aim is to recapture the spirit of Hoovervilles, the shanty towns that popped up and were named to tweak President Herbert Hoover's perceived inaction in the Great Depression's early years. Since Saturday night's kickoff, about 80 tents have sprung up in and around State Street in Madison, with a handful of people sticking it out throughout, but mostly fresh rounds of activists rotating through on a daily basis. Quote, just like the original Hoovervilles in the 1930s, we wanted to create that type of atmosphere without being destructive, says Boucher, a government affairs coordinator for the IBEW union. Some major differences, of course, are that Walkerville will only be up for 2 months. Its participants generally can go home, and it is more of a staged political event. Boucher noted that unlike the February protests, this edition is carefully planned with permits, rules, schedule of speakers, and a conscious effort to make a point without disrupting local businesses. There's a new theme each day. On Sunday, for instance, protests focused on planned $800 million cuts to K-12 education. And one of the most anticipated moments will be on Monday when hundreds of firefighters who were exempted from Walker's original collective bargaining law but could see cuts in its more recent incarnation are expected to march in Madison. It is highly unlikely that organizers at any point will match the tens of thousands who at times occupied the Capitol building in protest this winter. Times have changed, as have public sentiments and strategies. Much of their efforts recently centered around recall petitions aimed at ousting several Republican senators and turning the chamber over to Democrats. Because Democratic politicians care very deeply about the working man, and they always solve the problems that Republicans create. The end. Okay, I added that last line, but... All right, so let's look at the facts here of the Walkerville, based on Hoovervilles. Now, the story goes, if we go back to 1929 when the Depression started, Herbert Hoover was the president of the United States, and he was president until January of 1933. During this time, the story goes, he did absolutely nothing to try to correct the economic downturn, the Depression. He had a very laissez-faire approach, and the Depression got so bad because of his inaction. But then, good news, there was an election in 1932. Franklin Roosevelt won. He came into office. He knew what to do. He took charge. He started implementing all of these new programs that put people back to work, and America recovered from the Great Depression thanks to the policies of FDR. This is mythological, so let's deal with the Hoover part first. Herbert Hoover was an economic interventionist. And the truth is that when Roosevelt was running for president in 1932, he actually criticized Hoover for being too hands-on with the economy and claimed that Hoover's intervention was slowing the recovery. So let's try to break down these myths. And well, first of all, let's deal with the creation of the myth. I've put out a list several times on the show in the past of the people that I think were the most dangerous and destructive presidents that this country has had. Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, Bush, you know. So we're looking over a period of about 150 years there. I've mentioned several times on the show in the past that one of FDR's greatest admirers was the Nazi Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels. And I think that this is something worth looking at in just a little bit more detail. Roosevelt seemed to have this window of opportunity as far as shaping public opinion that the other terribles of presidential history didn't have for various reasons. When Lincoln was president, information traveled so slow, and as it went from place to place, it tended to be tweaked and manipulated a little bit, so by the time news of what Lincoln was doing got to, say, Alabama from Washington, the story might have changed considerably, people might have put their own spin on it, and there was really no way to fact-check any of the information. News traveled slow, news was easy to manipulate. Obviously, I'm not saying that it isn't easy to manipulate today, but there's just so many ways to debunk claims made by people with certain political interests or politicians or, you know, media pundits. But that didn't exist then. And that probably was a disadvantage to Lincoln. Of course, if you know the story of, you know, the lead up to the secession and the incident in South Carolina, Lincoln had no intention of doing anything to change slavery, but the perception in the South was that he was an abolitionist, which he was not. He was a white supremacist. He really did not care about that issue. I mean, he might have said a couple of things like, yeah, it would be better if everybody could be free, but shit, you know, what are you going to do? He probably said it a little bit more eloquently than that. He was a good speaker and a good writer. But Lincoln had no tools for the manipulation of public opinion, or to be more accurate there, he had no real media tools. The way that he ultimately wound up shifting public opinion was by using terrorism in the southern states, which is just, it's not called terrorism in the history books, it's called total war, where he just unleashes Philip Sheridan and William Tecumseh Sherman, burning villages, terrorizing people, cutting off food supplies. And you've seen Gone with the Wind, just lighting stuff on fire and scaring the crap out of people. That was total war, war on civilians, and that was Lincoln's tactic for shifting public opinion, specifically in the southern states. Now, when Wilson was president, there wasn't even AM radio. So there was no media manipulation to speak of during his presidency either. And of course, I mean, there was newspapers back then. But as far as the manipulation of the public mind is concerned, I think that the newer channels of media, radio and television, were far more effective in using emotional attacks to shape people's opinions. Like, it's always, if you want people to not think about something logically because you do not want them to discover the horrors of what you're doing, you frame things in an emotional way, not in a logical way. So you get people to think about something emotionally, and that's almost a guarantee that they can't think about it logically. And when you add pictures and music and, you know, tone and inflection, that's a much more persuasive presentation, even though the methods of persuasion are not sound and not honest. Roosevelt, well, let's do Bush first. Bush was the first president who, throughout his entire administration, was under the magnifying glass of the information age, where he is forced to deal with all kinds of scrutiny that every president prior to him had escaped, because the technology didn't exist to move information that fast, to get that many different opinions, to have such a variety of sources for information. I'm sure the internet existed when Clinton was president, but really after September 11th, people became junkies online all the time, getting their news online, and the online media really explodes, I think, in the first decade of the 21st century. Not that it didn't exist in the 90s, but Bush is really subjected to a kind of scrutiny that no other president is subjected to. And that makes, I think, maybe some of the questions and the investigations of online media slowed the agenda of the neoconservatives. That's, of course, conjecture, but I think that that's certainly possible. Now, Franklin Roosevelt was president in a pretty ideal time for the manipulation of public opinion. Gardner Goldsmith and I did a show on School Sucks podcast a little over a year ago where we looked at FDR, and one of our observations was that he seemed to be inventing the legend of himself in the moment. Where, you know, Lincoln, on the other hand, that was probably created by sort of apologists, and I don't mean apologists for slavery, I mean apologists for the brute force of government, you know, after the fact, and certainly after Lincoln was assassinated. That's a sure way to get lionized in history, is to get killed. Now, Wilson was not popular for, you know, the same reasons. They just didn't have the tools to control the public mind, you know, as effectively, and through the media. And when you don't have the media, you know, when you can't use propaganda to get tacit compliance and acquiescence, if you're the government, you resort to straight-up force. You know, for them, if we can't put your mind in a cage, we're going to put your body in a cage, but you're not going to be free. So for Wilson, we have things like the Espionage Act of 1917, which is, you know, similar to John Adams' Alien and Sedition Act. And interestingly enough, people, you would think that they would want to leave this in the corner of the cellar of forgotten embarrassments of the history of the U.S. government, but there are politicians who are talking about reviving the Espionage Act to go after people like Manning and Assange. And for Bush, even though the mainstream media showed tremendous subservience and loyalty to him in the lead-up to the Iraq War, and I mean, that includes everybody, the New York Times, MSNBC. If you go back and you watch MSNBC in the months leading up to war, there's a great movie about this called War Made Easy, actually. That shows just how enthusiastic everybody was in the mainstream media. But Bush also had to deal with what was going on the internet, which made things more difficult. He, like Wilson, like Lincoln, was not particularly popular during his presidency. But a lot of people loved FDR. And FDR was able to effectively control the public mind through the teachings of people like Bernays, Edward Bernays, who we've talked about on the show in the past. But it was 1935 when the real emotional assault on the public mind in the United States began with what was called the March of Time. This was a series of newsreels that were produced and shown in theaters prior to movies. And this is how people got their news. You want to talk about subservience to the state. The march of time, because they had to rely, they had to get, you know, to gather information to do their stories from very limited sources. Chief among those sources was the government. So the march of time was essentially, more often than not, just pro-state propaganda. The series actually featured dramatic reenactments of events. Right, so to people are going to see a movie, so they want to be entertained, and you know they want a protagonist and a villain and a happy ending, and this was news, and I think the March of Time was in these theaters and somewhat relevant, even though it was not really a moneymaker, all the way up until the advent of television. And the Roosevelt administration knew how to use these to build support for policies during the Depression. Of course, this continues right through the war. Now, let's look at one of these news reels. It would start out with Roosevelt giving a speech about something. Now, this is shown in a theater, so we see this cutting back and forth between Roosevelt giving the speech and then these staged scenes of people sitting there and listening to him on the radio. And today we are now, those two acts, I'm going to let this play. The ending is interesting.
It is time for courageous action, and the recovery bill gives us the means to conquer unemployment with exactly the same weapon that we have used to strike down child labor. The proposition is simply this: if all employers will act together to shorten hours and to raise wages, we can put people back to work. No employer will suffer because the relative level of competitive cost will advance by the same amount for all of them. But if any considerable group should lag or shirk, this great opportunity will pass us by and we will go into another desperate winter. This must not happen. The principle that applies to the employers applies to the workers as well. And I ask you workers to cooperate in the same spirit. That is why I am asking the employers of the nation to sign this common covenant with me, to sign it in the name of patriotism and in the name of humanity. That is why I am asking the workers of America to go along with us in a spirit of understanding and of helpfulness.
Well, dear, it looks as if we have the right man in the White House. He's surely leading the country back to better times.
He certainly is.
So this new tool that really emerges during the administration of FDR is exciting and inviting and compelling, and it pulls on the heartstrings, you know, the voice of the narrator, the music, the stage scenes with people. It's really incredibly persuasive in all kinds of dishonest ways. They knew what they were doing. And, you know, I was listening to Free Talk Live recently, and this old woman from the so-called Greatest Generation calls in while Mark and Ian are talking about their opposition to institutionalized mass slaughter, property destruction, and terrorism, which some people call defense or even war. And the caller, this woman, probably in her 80s, starts criticizing them and saying that the generation today is cowardly. And if we had these kind of cowards back in the 1930s and the 1940s, we'd all be speaking German right now. And then she goes on to say, you know, I lost my brother or I lost my husband, I don't remember exactly, so I understand these things. I know about war because I lived through World War II. I was a child when that happened, and I lost people that I cared about. I mean, there's multiple variations of the story, right? But I lost people that I cared about, so I understand the war. This is nonsense, right? I would say that people who lived through that and who suffered and lost through that understand it, you know, far less than we can today, even if you're, you know, 17 or 18, if you're getting the right information. Obviously, government school's not going to help you with that. But we don't have any emotional stake in our study of the Second World War. But these people do. I mean, first of all, they're being educated about the war while it's happening. Most of them may be children who still believe in the Easter Bunny at the time. very, very vulnerable targets to government propaganda. And then we have the loss, you know, death of loved ones. And I think one of the reasons why war and the acceptance of war has been perpetuated and accelerated all through the 20th century. Remember, when World War I started, people were like, what? We're going to go get involved in a war in Europe? You know, and World War II wasn't much different as far as the initial public support for the United States siding up with another murderous imperial power, Great Britain, against the murderous imperial power that was the Third Reich. But when people experience death, I think that there's a real propensity to try to make meaning out of that death, that war becomes noble and war becomes heroic, way, way beyond just necessary for defense. But war is this, you know, this courage and sacrifice. These are made into virtues. I'm sorry, self-sacrifice is not a virtue. Self-sacrifice for politicians is not heroic. But because so many of these people lost so much during this war, they had to make meaning out of that death. They couldn't have the courage of somebody like Cindy Sheehan and say, did my loved one die for no good reason? Did my loved one die for the agenda of politicians? Most people who had no access to information 60, 70 years ago were not asking themselves those questions. So my point, I guess, is that people who lived through this, how could they possibly understand the Depression? How could they possibly understand World War II if they were being manipulated in such an obvious and dishonest way? I mean, in retrospect, we can say that, but I don't think people then realized it, you know? And I think the story that I'm telling speaks to the earlier point of thinking about things emotionally. When people have to make this meaning out of the death of their loved ones because of these senseless wars, that is a total block to ever really evaluating that situation with a reasonable, logical, critical mind. And because of the propaganda of the 1930s and the 1940s, people had these events, the New Deal, the Depression, the war, probably even continued on into the Cold War. They had these things explained to them in these emotional terms. And the most powerful emotion has always been fear, I think. I mean, these newsreels, this is 40 years after the arrival of a train, this movie in 1895, where people get up and run out of the theater because the camera's situated in a way on the side of the tracks that this train is pulling up, and people thought the train was going to hit them. So we were 40 years beyond that in 1935. People running out of a theater because they didn't want a train to hit them. So we looked at the tools of propaganda. Now let's look at the facts. The narrative that's being created in the moment by the Roosevelt administration is that the Depression was the result of government inaction, or the severity of the Depression was the result of government inaction. But now here we are, and we're going to take action, and everybody needs to put their shoulders to the wheel and sacrifice and blah, blah, blah. So let's go back and look at Hoover. And I want to read an excerpt from a book called Great Myths of the Great Depression by Lawrence W. Reed. And in the book, Reed breaks the story of the Depression down into phases. The second phase is subtitled Disintegration of the World Economy. Though modern myth claims that the free market self-destructed in 1929, government policy was the debacle's principal culprit. If this crash had been like previous ones, hard times would have ended in 2 or 3 years at the most, and likely sooner than that. But unprecedented political bungling instead prolonged the misery for over 10 years. Unemployment in 1930 averaged a mildly recessionary 8.9%, up from 3.2% in 1929. It shot up rapidly until peaking out at more than 25% in 1933. Until March of 1933, these were the years of President Herbert Hoover, a man often depicted as a champion of non-interventionalist laissez-faire economics. And this part is subtitled, The Greatest Spending Administration in All of History. Did Hoover really subscribe to a hands-off-the-economy free market philosophy? His opponent in the 1932 election, Franklin Roosevelt, didn't think so. During the campaign, Roosevelt blasted Hoover for spending and taxing too much, boosting the national debt, choking off trade, and putting millions on the dole. He accused the president of, quote, reckless and extravagant spending, of thinking, quote, that we ought to center control of everything in Washington as rapidly as possible. Again, that's Roosevelt's criticism of Hoover. and a presiding over, one more quote, the greatest spending administration in peacetime in all of history. Roosevelt's running mate, John Nance Garner, charged that Hoover was leading the country down a path of socialism. Contrary to the conventional view about Hoover, Roosevelt and Garner were absolutely right. The crowning folly of the Hoover administration was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff passed in June of 1930. It came on top of the Fordney-McCumber Tariff of 1922, which had already put American agriculture in a tailspin during the preceding decade. The most protectionist legislation in U.S. history, Smoot-Hawley virtually closed the borders to foreign goods and ignited a vicious international trade war. Professor Barry Poulsen describes the scope of the act. And this is Poulsen's thoughts. The act raised the rates on the entire range of dutiable commodities. For example, the average rate increased from 20% to 34% on agricultural products, from 36 to 47% on wine, spirits, and beverages, from 50 to 60% on wool and woolen manufacturers. In all, 887 tariffs were sharply increased, and the act broadened the list of dutiable commodities to 3,218 items. Dutiable, that's a new word to me. I'm guessing it means that duties can be imposed on them. A crucial part of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff was that many tariffs were for a specific amount of money rather than a percentage of the price. As prices fell by half or more during the Great Depression, the effective rate of these specific tariffs doubled, increasing the protection afforded under the Act. Smoot-Hawley was as broad as it was deep, affecting a multitude of products. Before its passage, clocks had faced a tariff of 45%. The Act raised that to 55%, as much as another $4.50 per clock. Tariffs on corn and butter were roughly doubled. Even sauerkraut was tariffed for the first time. Among the few remaining tariff-free goods, strangely enough, were leeches and skeletons, perhaps as a political sop to the American Medical Association. Tariffs on linseed oil and casein hammered the U.S. paint, steel, and paper industries, respectively. More than 800 items used in automobile production were taxed by Smoot-Hawley. Most of the 60,000 people employed in U.S. plants making cheap clothing out of imported wool rags went home jobless after the tariff on wool rags rose by 140%. Officials in the administration and in Congress believed that raising trade barriers would force Americans to buy more goods made at home, which would solve the nagging unemployment problem. But they ignored an important principle of international commerce. Trade is ultimately a two-way street. If foreigners cannot sell their goods here, then they cannot earn the dollars they need to buy here. Or to put it another way, government cannot shut off imports without simultaneously shutting off exports. Another subtitle, we'll read a little more here. You tax me, I tax you. Foreign companies and their workers were flattened by Smoot-Hawley's steep tariff rates, and foreign governments soon retaliated with trade barriers of their own. With their ability to sell in the American market severely hampered, they curtailed their purchases of American goods. American agriculture was particularly hit hard. With a stroke of the presidential pen, farmers in this country lost nearly a third of their markets. Farm prices plummeted, and tens of thousands of farmers went bankrupt. A bushel of wheat that sold for $1 in 1929 was selling for a mere 30 cents by 1932. With the collapse of agriculture, rural banks failed in record numbers, dragging down hundreds of thousands of their customers. 9,000 banks closed their doors in the United States between 1930 and 1933. The stock market, which had regained much of the ground it had lost since the previous October, tumbled 20 points on the day Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley into law, and it fell almost without respite for the next 2 years. The market's high, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was set on September 3, 1929, at 381. It hit its 1929 low of 198 on November 13th, then rebounded to 294 by April 30th. It declined again as the tariff bill made its way towards Hoover's desk in June and did not bottom out until it reached a mere 41 2 years later. It would be a quarter century before the Dow would climb to 381 again. The shrinkage in world trade brought on by tariff wars helped set the stage for World War II a few years later. In 1929, the rest of the world owed American citizens $30 billion. Germany's Weimar Republic was struggling to pay the enormous reparations bill imposed by the disastrous Treaty of Versailles. When tariffs made it nearly impossible for foreign businessmen to sell their goods in American market. The burden of their debts became massively heavier and emboldened demagogues like Adolf Hitler. When goods do not cross frontiers, armies will, warns an old but painfully true maxim. One more section. Free markets or free lunches? Smoot-Hawley itself should lay to rest the myth that Hoover was a free market practitioner, but there is even more to the story of his administration's interventionist mistakes. Within a month of the stock market crash, he convened conferences of business leaders for the purpose of jawboning them into keeping wages artificially high, even though both profits and prices were falling. Consumer prices plunged almost 25% between 1929 and 1933, while nominal wages on average decreased only 15%. Translating into a substantial increase in wages in real terms, a major component of the cost of doing business. As economist Richard Ebling notes, the high-wage policy of the Hoover administration and the trade unions succeeded only in pricing workers out of the labor market, generating an increasing circle of unemployment. Hoover increased government spending for subsidy and relief schemes. In the space of 1 year alone, from 1930 to 1931, the federal government share of the gross national product soared from 16.4% to 21.5%. Hoover's agricultural bureaucracy doled out hundreds of millions to wheat and cotton farmers, even as the new tariffs wiped out their markets. His Reconstruction Finance Corporation ladled out billions more in business subsidies. Commenting decades later on Hoover's administration, Rexford Guy Tugwell, one of the architects of Franklin Roosevelt's policies of the 1930s, explained, quote, "We didn't admit it at the time, but practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started," unquote. Oh, and as an epilogue, in 1932, Hoover doubled the income tax. So does anybody know about this? Are kids learning about this in school? Having a deeper understanding of the stock market crash in 1929, subsequent depression, that would require a deeper understanding of economics, and you're not going to get that in school. I went on YouTube, and I wanted to see what was out there as far as videos comparing the policies of Hoover to policies of Roosevelt, what would perpetuate the mythology, what would debunk it. And I found plenty of great stuff by authors like Emily Schles and, of course, Tom Woods. But I also ran into a public school history project where the students set out to inform their classmates and YouTube audience about the story of the Great Depression and the recovery. Ironically, they decided the most informative method would be a 1930s-style newsreel. I'll play a clip.
The date, October 20th. The year 1932 and the presidential elections are nearing. It has been 3 years since the stock crash of 1929, and we are still suffering the horrible effects. Many banks are closed because they cannot handle the amount of money that is withdrawn. Many ask, where is Hoover? What has been doing to help our economy?
I feel such a thrill.
Absolutely nothing.
When they swing that music, rhythm like that,
we were dealt a bad hand as Americans.
Oh, you can't blame me for wanting to dance. From what I
thus ruined our economy and put us in this depression. Someone says we deserve a new deal, and that someone is Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
When they swing that music for me.
Roosevelt is a man of action who will be signing laws and bills in his first days of presidency to make sure that our economy is saved and this will not happen again. In his New Deal is an education program that will make sure our posterity and kids are well educated. Another program included in the New Deal is a healthcare program for all citizens. This will make sure that everyone is living a healthy life, even for homeless people. As you can see, Franklin Delano Roosevelt cares about the people of this country and will offer all his services to keep them healthy. Also, there will be a new military plan that makes sure our soldiers are trained for the most grueling battles. You know, just in case a fascist rises to power in Germany. Not that that will happen or anything. Unemployment rate is at an all-time high, but Roosevelt plans to fix this by making room for hundreds of thousands of jobs in the current businesses. Roosevelt will also introduce CCC camps with GIVE, which give homeless adults shelter, food, and work. The government will give the people money to restart their lives. Roosevelt cares about every single citizen of America and loves to spend time with the public. Any means to protect this country and is not afraid to use war. It will lift up the economy with the help of every citizen in this country. You know who is going to save our country. You know who is giving us another chance. Vote FDR in this coming election.
Now, some of you might be saying, hey, wasn't this supposed to be a show about teachers' unions, you rambling nitwit? Well, yeah, but this is what happens. See, just like it would be nice if every minute of School Sucks podcast could be devoted to alternatives and solutions and fresh, exciting new ideas about real education, before you can reach for the stars, you have to climb out of the giant hole that somebody threw you into a long time ago. Because it would be terrific. I mean, here's what I mean. It would be terrific if we could look at these headlines about what this myth that these people are trying to put forward in Wisconsin about, recapturing the spirit of rebellion against Herbert Hoover's inaction with our Walkerville. And we could just say, oh, that's too bad. Those people don't understand economics and they don't know the history of the Depression. Good thing they don't have any political power, so they can't take these misconceptions and use them to manipulate people into accepting bad ideas and policies for their own gain, and move on. But that's not exactly where we are. It's a little bit more dire than that. Walkerville. Okay, so in everything that comes with it, the heroism of big government action to solve problems for the little people, the working people, all embedded into this very clever slogan. And all of the impact that can have on public opinion, that can be accomplished in 5 seconds. We're calling it Walkerville. It's to recapture the spirit of blah, blah, blah. And for a public that is disarmed intellectually, that does not understand current events in context, that has no conception of the chronology that led up to the problems of today, for them, they hear the rhetoric of, the public sector unions or whoever is trying to benefit from the aggression of the state. And they say, yeah, oh, totally. Hoover bad, Roosevelt good, action good. We like action. Totally on your side. We don't even have any questions. What could we question? Your arguments are airtight. So in that environment, it takes 5 seconds for them to present this very powerful but entirely false idea. It just took me 25 minutes to take it apart. And I wasn't even that thorough. Now, these people in Wisconsin, they're teachers. They are providing this supposed education. But for some reason, they think it's acceptable to talk to adults like fifth graders. And you can hear them one after another. They get up there and they're like, oh yeah, we want the government to do stuff, because when people don't want the government to do stuff to help people who work and people who are children, that's when bad stuff happens. And if you don't want the government to do stuff, that means you want bad stuff to happen to children and people who work hard. What you should want the government to do is give stuff to the teachers' unions, because somehow that helps the children. And if you don't want to help the children, and you don't want to help people who are working, that's evil. And if you're evil, you probably are rich, because evil people are rich. And they want to see us eat garbage and have nothing and suffer. And then they're going to fly above us in their helicopters, and they're going to look down and laugh and say, ha ha ha, look at all of those children and hardworking people eating garbage. Well, I'm eating caviar in my helicopter. And I think I just explained the Republican Party. And that passes as sufficient. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little. And we should hear from them. We should hear from the unions. We should hear from the beneficiaries of aggression, because clearly I am exaggerating. No one ever said that. I made all that up. I mean, I think the general thrust is the same, but we should hear that, because capitalizing on people's misunderstanding or lack of understanding of history. It's more than just that. And honestly, I don't even think most of them know that they're doing it. I think most of these people are at these rallies are just repeating things that were handed down from the upper echelons of the union. You know, these talking points. And like the politicians, they don't think these things are going to be questioned. But there's something else going on that I think needs to be pointed out. All right, so we're going to use a couple of blogs, and we're going to deal with rhetoric and the misrepresentation of facts, which is another component in the message and the ideas that are being put forward by these public sector unions, including the teachers' unions, and those supporting their causes in the media. So this is from the AFL-CIO Now blog that can be found at blog.aflcio.org. This is called Walkerville Day 2, Respect K-12 Teachers and Students. And what it does is it goes through and it just has a few blurbs written by different people who are involved in this. One of the women, Jill H., who is a teacher, had this to say. The budget proposal put forth by Republicans reduces funding for each student by 5.5% for a total reduction in revenue for K-12 education by $1.68 billion over the next biennium. And in case you went to government school, a biennium, that is bi is two, ENN is year, so that means a two-year period. I guess that's how Wisconsin does their budgets. Now, before I even go any further, this is a 5.5% decrease per student, okay, which already sounds relatively insignificant when we think about how overfunded public education already is, as far as quality of the product that's returned. But this is not every student over the next 2 years saying, oh, you know, because they made these cuts, I got 5.5% less of the money that would have been used on me if the cuts hadn't been made. No, this money goes to pay administrators, it goes to pay teachers who pay union dues, who pay for media and lobbyists and all that other stuff. Right, so this is not money that's handed to children and families. So here's the ruse. What they do is they take the amount that's going to be cut that mostly the unions, the teachers, and school administrators, who I don't think in many cases are unionized, benefit from, and then they put it in a division problem as the numerator, and they put the amount of students in the public schools in Wisconsin in the denominator, and they do a division problem. And they say, oh, it's this much money less per every student. Every student gets this much less because of this. It's probably a significant amount of money. I mean, 5%? It's, I don't know. Or maybe she only says 5.5% because it's not a significant amount of money. Maybe the cost, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the average cost in the United States is $10,000, $12,000 per pupil. So in Wisconsin, maybe it's a little less, maybe it's a little more, but 5% of that, not very significant. 5% of 10,000 is $500. But as this statistic was presented in the article, it looks like something that's going to have a serious impact on individual children. And that's misleading. And of course, it's important to recognize that none of these people we're going to hear from are the shadowy molders of public opinion. But they do have the ears and the minds of the students, and I think that that really, really counts for something. Because then, you know, the rest of this media stuff is swallowed whole. If this is the message, I mean, we heard from the students and their assessment of economics and their assessment of history when it came to FDR. That's the message that's being put forward in these schools. So I think that even though these people are not particularly powerful individually in a political sense, these are the ideas that are being pushed in those schools. But that 5.5% thing, see, numbers sound like facts, don't they? Statistics sound like facts. Now, here's another example from later in the article. And this is from a subtitle called Stop the Race to the Bottom. Beyond direct effects on students, the Republican-controlled legislature is also continuing its drive to do away with collective bargaining rights for teachers, along with other public sector workers in Wisconsin. According to the WEAC, which is another union, Wisconsin teachers now rank 23rd nationally in pay, the lowest level in 50 years. And the sad thing is, I guarantee I've done this before. you know, scrambling to finish a show. I mean, maybe not, but I wouldn't be surprised if I had done this. If I had used statistics in a misleading way to back up my idea. You know, without really, really evaluating, because obviously I can put the critical eye on these people, but maybe a little bit I'm subject to my own confirmation bias once in a while, and I see some statistics and I say, yeah, okay, great, that'll back it up. Beep, beep. We all need to be careful of this. And I, you know, I'm sure I've done this. If not on the show, then definitely in conversation at some point. Probably more than once. But that last statistic there, this is completely irrelevant. Ranked 23rd out of 50 states, the lowest in 50 years. Completely irrelevant. Now, if I had to assign a title to this tactic, I would call it stacking the deck. Because statistics are complicated, right? And, you know, I hope that if you can think about some of the stuff I said earlier in the show, when I read from Reed's book about myths of the Great Depression, there's a lot of numbers in that. So if you can pick that apart and tell me if I'm wrong anywhere, great. I will be happy to correct myself on the show. You know, I tend to think that economic policies that are based on self-ownership and non-aggression are more sound, and perhaps, you know, when people are espousing similar ideas, I tend to be more trusting of them than I should without looking at it with a little bit more scrutiny. So let me know if you can find anything in that. But stacking the deck is where people pile up supposed facts or misleading statistics that, you know, argue in favor of their point, but they're only listing examples or they're only kind of cherry-picking things that support their cause. And when this person points out that Wisconsin has dropped to 23rd, the lowest in 50 years, still in the top half, and the other thing is it's only comparing what they pay teachers in other states. And it's all funded with the same methods. It's all funded by the initiation of force through property taxes. So I don't see how that's a relevant statistic, that we're falling out of the top half of people who have their paychecks delivered to them by theft. But what has proven to be the most useful, probably the most frequent, and one of the most disingenuous forms of rhetorical trickery, I would call it the irrelevant conclusion. Now, before I knew a lot about names of logical fallacies, I would call this the bear trap, the bait and switch, or the cloaking device. That was the way I described it before to other people, but this is what the irrelevant conclusion is. It's when a person making an argument will use bait to spring a trap. They'll use one conclusion as bait to spring the trap of the real conclusion or the real action. So in the case of the teachers, it is education for the children. The trap is using the force of the government to get whatever they want. You know, to have laws passed in their favor, to improve their working conditions, to pad their pensions, to ensure pay raises, so on and so forth. But, I mean, this is everywhere. This goes way beyond public sector unions. We saw a lot of this in the last 10 years. 2001, 2003, all of the apologies later on for the war in Iraq. The bait was national defense. Our national interest, stabilization and democracy in the Middle East, security. The trap was the war. The trap was the debt. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's really important to get people to define their terms. What do you mean by education? What do you mean by defense? Those things sound great. But what do you really mean? Do you know what you really mean? Or even, are you just overly focused on the good intentions, so much so that you overlook the road to hell in the background? And the irrelevant conclusion can also work in the opposite way. Let's go over to the SEIU blog. The SEIU is the Service Employees International Union. And I'm going to read you two paragraphs of a three-paragraph article that presents itself as a news article. The title is Walkerville Tent City Erected in Protest of Governor Walker's Attempt to Hurt Kids, Families, and Seniors. So here we see the use of the irrelevant conclusion, but in a different way. I have no reason to trust that Walker really wants to help the economy in Wisconsin, that he really cares about the people there. He's a politician. I don't trust him. But, you know, the truth is that maybe cutting into these bloated public sector unions might have some positive results, short and long term, for the economy and the people of that state. Like, when you reduce the number of termites living in your house is probably going to last a little bit longer. But what we do as the public sector union is we swing out in front of the potential benefits of cutting into, you know, our lifestyles, and we put this fearful assertion that Walker's goal, Walker's attempt, it says it in the headline, Walker's attempt to hurt kids, families, and seniors. Now, who could be for that? Are you sick? You know, this is a combination of specious argumentation here. Because you also have the appeal to fear, you have the appeal to emotion, and you have an ad hominem attack. It's implied by the author, and I think it will certainly be inferred by the reader, that if they skip across that quickly, that Walker is on a mission to hurt people. Now, that's a personal attack. I might not even disagree with it. I'm just saying that it's disingenuous. The article continues. And, oh, byline, by SEIU Communications. No author that prevents somebody from getting, like, inconvenient objections and questions in email. Hundreds of teachers, nurses, truck drivers, students, and other Wisconsinites have gathered outside the Capitol in a makeshift tent city to challenge the reckless actions by Governor Scott Walker and Republicans to crush education, healthcare, and programs for senior citizens. Reckless actions by Governor Scott Walker and Republicans to crush education, healthcare, and programs for seniors. Same fallacy as the headline. Nicknamed Walkerville by a local activist, a reference to the tent cities created by Hoover's reckless actions during the Great Depression, those gathered are determined to remind Governor Walker that they will not remain silent while he makes bad choices for Wisconsin. Nice symmetry there, huh, between the recklessness of Walker and the recklessness of Hoover. So we've been going for a while here, and we could certainly go on, and I'm sure you might have detected that there is still some anger for me when it comes to this whole subject, even months later. There was a lot of ground I could have covered on this topic on the show that I decided to avoid. I just didn't know how productive my treatment could be because this became a very upsetting, very frustrating issue for me, especially when I tried to reach out to some of the people in Wisconsin to get them to come on the show. I was attacked. I had my Facebook account temporarily suspended. I was threatened. I received nasty emails. And I really can't even explain how vicious and nasty some of these people were. They went onto my Facebook page and started taking, like, screenshots of things that I had written and pictures of me and, you know, making accusations about who I was and who I worked for. And one of them claimed that the college that I went to didn't exist, stuff like that. And it was an entirely unpleasant experience. But I hope that looking at these recent developments with a more critical eye is both helpful and somewhat productive, and we will continue to do this on the future with this subject and others. In closing today, I hope I've made you more aware of this irrelevant conclusion, this bait and switch, or this bear trap fallacy. So when I talk to people, I try to get them to define their terms. What do you mean by national interest? What do you mean by defense? What the hell do you mean by education? And it's very important to distinguish the bait from the trap, because with this situation in Wisconsin that is spreading now across the country, we have these little children being marched out. Look at their little faces, listen to them sing, listen to them chant. This is what democracy looks like. How could you want to hurt them? How could you want to hurt these children by cutting into the benefits and the pensions of their teachers? And sooner or later, oh, snap. Thanks for listening, and take care.